Welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift, and joining me from New York is Rafat Ali. How are you doing?
Hey, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Just overwhelmed by my everything that's going on in the news, whether it's gadget news or politics and the Democratic Convention this week. You know, for a media junkie and a political junkie like me, it's a little bit of overload, to say the least.
Yeah, there's so much happening. There's politics, there's that, and there's on TV, of course, besides politics, there's the U.S. Open and I guess football as well for people who I don't watch football, but that's also happening. It's like everything is happening at once.
Yeah, I guess Obama had to change his speech time just to or they had to move the football game from Thursday to Wednesday just to accommodate Obama's speech, which is kind of funny too.
Yeah, and then of course in our tech media world, this like announcement today first was Nokia, Microsoft, and then today's Amazon happening as we're speaking right now. Then iPhone is coming next week.
Oh, and everything that's going on with Samsung, you know, after their lawsuit. You know, they lost their lawsuits here. I think they won some in Japan, and you know, it's interesting to see all these announcements. And you start thinking about, okay, if you're going to announce a new device, is it going to immediately be sued for something or for copying? I guess.
Yeah.
And with a larger Kindle Fire coming out, you know, that's more the size of the iPad. You have to wonder about that too.
Yeah, and I don't even know the details because there's literally being talked about the second we're recording the show, a Kindle HD or something, which is a larger 8-inch screen or something.
They're saying it's $159 for the Kindle Fire that's a 7-inch tablet, but I believe there's a larger one too.
Yeah, Kindle 8.9-inch Kindle Fire HD.
There you go.
That's what
they're saying. So I know you're an Amazon fanboy, so you've got a lot of gear. You've got a lot of gear to get now.
I am a fanboy, but I've stopped buying any gadgets at this point. I can read books on the Kindle that I already have. I have a first generation iPad that still works. And so while I keep buying stuff from Amazon, the regular stuff that usually daily or whatever else stuff.
So you're not in, you know, one of them is called a paper light, which has like an illuminated display, and that's not, and a touch screen, and that's not enough for you, huh?
No, it's not even. It's not
that won't entice you. Come on.
No, it's not even the enough part. It's just that I can do stuff with the devices, all the stuff that I need to do through my existing devices at this point. So, it's who knows? I mean, I don't know. I'm running a startup now, so I gotta keep the expenses down. So I think that's the difference between when we were talking, I think, last year on the show about Amazon and then. Now.
So how are you? One of the things we did last week, we talked about the Republican convention. This week, we'll talk to some folks at the Democratic convention. How are you following the conventions? I mean, I've been watching a little bit on TV, but I have to say that even when I'm watching a speech on TV, like Bill Clinton's, you know, 45-minute speech, you know, I can't help but have a Twitter, you know, feed watching that and looking on Facebook and seeing how people are reacting. It's like, you almost feel naked if you're not watching that too.
Yeah. I mean, this is my first as a citizen. I became a citizen last year, so this is my first election that I'll vote in officially as an American citizen. So for me, I'm thinking like, how did people even watch any of these conventions without Twitter or Facebook? Because it's boring as hell. And but with Twitter and Facebook, they become so much more fun because, of course, I mean, you know this, and I know we've talked about it, that we are the people that we follow on Twitter and Facebook and maybe other places as well. Our self-selected group, probably most likely identifying with your views, our views, and our worldview. So that means we are reinforcing each other's views, making fun of the same things and liking the same things. But even that said, it's just so much more fun.
Yeah, and I mean, you can look at a hashtag, you know, like the DNC hashtag or the GOP hashtag from last week, and you get there's always people kind of subverting whatever the company line is, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, liberal, conservative, or in between. You know, people do seem to be kind of jumping in and saying things on different sides if you follow the hashtags, I guess.
Yeah, and then it's funny because, like, last night in Clinton's speech, Bill Clinton's speech, of course, there's us, all of us commenting and tweeting and stuff. Then there are other, like, comedians and stuff that you follow, like, that are Twitter savvy, that then, of course, are 10 times funnier than regular people like us, and that
Yeah.
tweet about the show. And of course, Clinton jokes are of course back again. So in Twitter, they work really well. So yeah, it's just fascinating too. There's no way you cannot watch RCDNC or even elections that are going to come up that day and not have Twitter and Facebook on.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, I'm sure for Bill Clinton, someone who's given so many speeches at conventions before, he's never probably been, instantly fact-checked by the masses as he gave his speech, similar to what happened with Romney and Ryan last week. Okay, so on this show, we'll talk to some folks at the Democratic National Convention, including someone from Facebook and someone from Twitter to talk about this very subject. And then we'll turn to the new set of Amazon devices that were just announced, as well as an ebook pricing settlement that just came up between three big publishers and the states over an antitrust price fixing lawsuit and what that means for the pricing of ebooks. So now we'll turn to the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte. The national conventions have been awash in digital and social media initiatives, and Twitter has been a chattering back channel for the past 10 days from both conventions. We've seen an even higher volume of tweets this week during the DNC, with Michelle Obama getting more tweets than Mitt Romney last week, according to Twitter's own count. But will it all matter in the end? How much will social media really bring out the vote or sway the vote? Joining us is Adam Sharp, Twitter's Senior Manager of Government News and Social Innovation. He leads a team driving creative use of the platform by governments, political candidates, journalists, nonprofit organizations, and the faith community. Previously, he was Executive Director for Digital Services at C-SPAN. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
And Ari Melber is an attorney, television commentator, and correspondent for The Nation magazine. During the 2008 presidential election, Melber traveled with the Obama campaign on special assignment for the Washington Independent. And previously, he was a legislative aide in the U.S. Senate and is a staff member of the 2004 John Kerry presidential campaign. Welcome, Ari.
Thanks. The only other thing we can add is that I'm losing my voice here in Charlotte, so we'll see how it goes.
You and Bill Clinton. And also, we have Adam Connor, who's manager for public policy in Facebook's Washington, D.C. office, where he focuses on government and political outreach and has directed the company's election efforts since 2007. Previously, Adam was the director of online communications for Congresswoman Louise Slaughter. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So, Adam Sharp, let's start with you. We've seen, when you go on Twitter and you're looking at the hashtags for the RNC and DNC during the conventions, there's kind of this really nicely produced page that comes up. And I'm curious, how do you create that page? Do you work in conjunction with the conventions themselves?
Well, actually, that page is part of an evolving experiment that we've been doing now for a few different events. We launched a similar exercise with NASCAR earlier this season, then more recently for the Olympics, and now for the Republican National Convention and the Democratic National Convention. So when users go to twitter.com/#DNC2012, they have an enhanced experience, really highlighting those highest quality tweets that give the strongest insider perspective from the hall on the entire experience of attending the convention. So you'll see that across the top, we feature a photo stream of pictures from inside the hall, and from high-profile users. You can actually watch the convention live with a video stream that we have in partnership from YouTube, and then participate in real time with your own tweets and following those from others. So this is a mix of various signals, really trying to find the most relevant and meaningful tweets to expose users to give them a more complete experience around the convention.
And do you guys actually have editors that are choosing things? How do you decide what goes on those pages?
Well, actually, the strongest signal comes from our users themselves and looking at that content that gets the highest engagement from Twitter users who are watching the convention, retweeting and favoriting things that are of interest to them. We also have tried to put a focus on the speakers and delegates we know are in the hall and making sure that those are being exposed so that people at home can be experiencing the convention through the eyes of those that we've confirmed to be on the ground. And yes, there is a backup plan, if you will, that if there is some just incredible tweet out there that is not being caught by those automated systems, that we can make sure it's featured and visible to our users.
Now, do you guys kind of sanitize what goes on that page? I mean, do you make sure that something that's not kind of off-key or a little too strange gets onto that page?
Well, the primary signal, as I said, is relevant. So it's looking for content that is relevant to the convention. So off-key in terms of not being relevant to the convention, we make an effort to curate out of the experience. But we've actually made an effort to separate the curation of that page from the work we do with the party organization so that, you know, there is no message effort on that page and so that you're getting voices from both sides, not just convention supporters or party supporters.
Okay. Now, Adam Connor with Facebook, I saw with the Republican convention, they had this app that they put together, Convention Without Walls, to kind of bring in stories from different people. What have you guys done as far as the conventions go? Have you set up any special pages or worked with the conventions in any way?
That's an interesting question. You know, I think my colleague Katie was just down in Tampa, and I'm out here in Charlotte, and we're working with a variety of folks. We are working with the convention itself to make sure that they can help achieve their goal of making this one of the more open and most open and accessible conventions, whether it's for the people in the arena or the folks who are outside of the arena. And so it's, I think, something that's been great to watch them integrate with their digital team, and obviously the Obama team, which draws upon the vast resources of not only a very large page that the president has on Facebook, but also, you know, pages for Bill Clinton and Michelle Obama and some of the other very prominent speakers that we've had. So we've been working with them on the presence of the campaign itself. In addition, ensuring that folks with delegates who are here are able to share their experience. You know, there are thousands of delegates here, many of which have, you know, on average, if they're a Facebook user, 190 friends on Facebook. And, you know, when they are sharing that experience with their friends and they're posting photos from the convention, when they're, sharing status updates with their friends, you know, they're really turning themselves into distributors in a way we haven't seen before. So that's really exciting. And then we're also just, you know, helping highlight to the press some of the buzz that we're seeing. So, for instance, last night, Bill Clinton and his speech was the most buzzed about Facebook political kind of figure of the last two conventions. And his use of the word arithmetic, which, as you know, kicked off a fairly lengthy discussion about budgets and other stats, was really something that took off as well on Facebook. I jumped 41,000% on Facebook in that time to mention the use of the word arithmetic. So, you know, there's a lot going on, and both online and off, and I think as increasingly we see this melding of the real world and the online world to help with things come together.
And Ari, what are you seeing there at the convention itself as far as innovations go? I mean, we see it outside of Charlotte. You know, we're following it on so many different ways. We're following it on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, streaming video, TV, radio, you name it. What's going on exactly in the convention itself? Do you see people really multitasking when it comes to reporting?
You don't see a lot of multitasking from the delegates. They're pumped up. They're here. They waited to get here, and they are dead on looking at the main speeches. You obviously see the media doing 2 and 3 screens. We know that. But what I think is really interesting from a civic perspective, to echo some of what's already been said, is that the press, which obviously still has a gatekeeper role to play, is increasingly seeing real-time reactions. You can see what Republicans, Democrats, and Independents are making of this. You can see what ideas are catching on. You know, you could see that arithmetic became a global hashtag, that there's a hunger out there for numbers, facts, and fact-checking, which has been a theme throughout the campaign and something we've talked about in Media Shift as well. So I think that part is very interesting, and the press, more so than, this is the third Democratic convention I've attended in a row, and more so than the past two, I see the press really attempting to dip into what the response is in real time. That usually would happen later, man on the street, woman on the street type thing. Obviously, people are here and you can interview them directly. You don't need to only go online. But online, in many ways, provides richer data.
No question. And, I mean, you wrote this great story about how fact-checking has become almost a viral thing. And it's almost a sport that's happening not only by a place like PolitiFact and factcheck.org, but it's also being done by average people online in real time as the speech happens.
That's right. And what we saw, at least in the Paul Ryan address, partly because there were so many dubious statements, was some of the most shared items were about fact-checking. Bill Clinton, maybe not a fair comparison because he's got to be one of the most data-driven presidents we've ever had. There was less fact-checking going viral because there were less facts that were open to dispute. Bloomberg News did their own comprehensive fact check and said on balance most of his claims checked out. So we're always going to see the content drive at first. I mean, social media is not going to do more than react. But when the text, if you will, when the main thing happening has holes, we're seeing social media hit back really hard and we're seeing the press echo that. And I think that's really good for the quality of the race, the debate of the race, regardless of whether people have already made up their minds or, as obviously is a component of it, partisans will jump on circulating fact checks that only help their side. So there's a partisan use of objective material, but in the end, I would argue that online that still can serve to inform people better than if there was no heat behind the sharing.
Now, Adam Sharp with Twitter, you know, we keep seeing these numbers about, you know, so many tweets per minute and there's so much more Twitter activity around the Democratic convention. And I've heard that might be because there's just more social media use by Democrats versus Republicans. I think Pew came out with a report showing that. Is that what you guys are seeing in your numbers as well? Should there be kind of a caveat behind some of those numbers?
Well, I think obviously one of the problems is when you sign up for a Twitter account, we don't ask you your political affiliation, so it's hard to put hard numbers behind that. Pew suggested one way. Engage DC had a study that found it another way. What we have found in our work with the Twitter Political Index is that, you know, we're not looking here at the overall Twitter population of all Twitter users that probably does skew younger and more tech savvy. We're looking at the universe of Twitter users who are actively talking about politics. And in this Twitter Political Index, the final result has tracked very closely to the Gallup approval ratings for the president for 2 years now. When you pulled up the numbers for both the president and Mitt Romney going back, Bill, till May, when we started measuring this head-to-head count, that averages out to roughly the same difference that we see in the public polling. We saw the same shifts that the public polling saw, or the Republican convention, which was a bit of a bump for Romney midweek following his wife's speech, tapering off to a slight bump by the end of the convention, and then those gains actually evaporating entirely by the time the weekend was over. So for the slice of the Twitter community that is actively engaged and talking about politics, we actually do see a pretty diverse cross-section of the electorate that is relatively well balanced. Now that said, when we look at some of these counts, you're right, Michelle Obama's speech hit a peak much higher than the peaks we saw for Ann Romney the week before. The TV ratings were also higher. So a great variety of factors can influence sort of what is driving that reaction. but it's something that we continue to watch very closely.
I have a question, Mark. This is Rafat. Any of the Adams, do you have, or are you working with any of the sort of media companies that are webcasting or broadcasting the TV, on TV, on any sort of links on how social media is driving higher viewership? Is there a direct correlation that you guys can make, or is there some sense that you guys have of that?
We're working very closely with CNN as one of our partners this cycle, and I think what we're doing is bringing some of that data analysis from us to also have it be enhancing on the broadcast one. So I encourage you to take a look at our Facebook CNN Election Insights at cnn.com/FB Insights, and it's I think it'll be pretty interesting to take a look at. I also would just say generally that, you know, I think as Adam hinted to, you know, you do see a correlation between obviously things that are making a splash in the media landscape and in the real world and their activity online. So you know, on our what we call our buzz meter, for instance, the Republican convention rocked in at about a 6.4 on a scale of 1 to 10. The Ryan pick was somewhere around a 5.12, and the election itself in 2008 was somewhere in the area of like an 8.9. So, you know, I think obviously those are all kind of scale. I think one of the interesting things is that while people will spend some of this time saying, are these conventions still relevant? Is it something that is important? The flip side is certainly it does serve as a media event. It does focus the attention, and certainly we are seeking that.
Yeah, I mean, we've got, 15,000 media people there, 5,000 delegates, so it's almost just like a media horde or something that's really descending on the conference, right, Ari?
Right. I mean, I think this is something where the press knows it's crazy but can't stop, and that's addict behavior, but addict behavior is a part of life. I think that this is unquestionably important. Whether you need to physically be here or not is an open question for all the reasons we've been discussing. I do think, though, that the theme and the cliche that conventions don't matter anymore or don't make news is totally false, lazy, and probably elitist. They matter most to the people who are not following this regularly, but we know from the ratings and other indicia that were just discussed, people who follow it less but tune in to get a direct, and I would emphasize, unpurchased a presentation of the campaign ideas from the candidates. So there's definitely a reason for the press to cover that, whether they're doing it in person or on the cheap from far.
Do you guys think that all this social media, you know, there's so much monitoring going on and infographics and stats? I mean, we're just more than we've ever seen before, obviously. I mean, do you think this election will actually be swayed in some way by what's going on in social media? I know it's hard to track that, but do you guys believe either of the Adams that social media might either be a good predictor or affect the election in some way?
Well, I think, and this is Adam Sharp here, I think that, you know, we're very careful. The goal here is not to be a predictive tool. You know, we are capturing conversation. You know, we are not asking the question, who do you intend to vote for? We are essentially just measuring what people are naturally talking about. And that could be very powerful because just a cycle ago, these conversations would have been behind the doors of the coffee shop and the office water cooler and absolutely inaccessible. And so we don't see things like the Twitter political index as replacing polling so much as enhancing it. You know, radar did not replace the thermometer, but it gives forecasters a more complete picture of the weather. In the same way that when the Twitter index and Gallup poll point in the same direction, it gives you some more confidence in the data. But when they point in different directions, that's an opportunity to dig deeper and understand what's going on, because it's a signal that perhaps what's happening with the electorate is more complex than what the polls are indicating. So I do think, I wouldn't go as far to say as that social media will be predictive, but it is giving us a more complete picture of the electorate with which to forecast.
You know, this is Adam Connor. I think I agree with that in part. And I think the other thing to keep in mind is, look, voting is still a physical act, and it's still something rooted in an envelope being mailed or a lever being pulled or a piece of paper being filled out. And so the connection for these campaigns and the goal of winning is still rooted in the physical. And, you know, we see a lot of use of Facebook as an organizing tool to touch actual voters. So people on Facebook are real people. These are their real friends, and these are real voter contacts. So if you look, for instance, at the new application the Obama campaign has rolled out, on Facebook, they are able to check your voter registration status on Facebook. They're able to check to see which friends you might have in swing states and encourage them to check their voter registration status and let yourself commit to vote. You know, so these are organizing tools that interact with the real world and widen that funnel that allow more people to participate and let them have more touches and more places with the voters they need to get to the polls. Because at the end of the day, you know, this campaign is about, winning an election, whatever side you may be on. And so I think that is something that, you know, for the last couple of months we've been in, and even year, we've been in a different phase of the election, and that all changes after today. You know, the campaigns that are run from today forward are fundamentally different than what's been run for the last year, and it's really now an all-out sprint into persuasion, into the debates, and voter turnout.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, guys. I really appreciate you joining us, and enjoy the rest of the conference if you can with all the work and everything you've got ahead of you.
Thanks. Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
So next we'll talk about the Amazon announcement of its new tablets and e-reader, as well as an e-book settlement on pricing. Today, Amazon announced a new line of Kindles, one being even cheaper than its previous cheapest Kindle, as well as a new Fire, a larger Kindle Fire, to compete perhaps more directly with the iPad. And we'll also talk about an e-book settlement over prices. Last week, three big book publishers, Hachette, Simon & Schuster, and HarperCollins, decided to settle with the states over price fixing of e-books. And two other publishers, Macmillan and Penguin, as well as Apple, have decided to fight the case in court. At issue is whether the publishers and Apple colluded to set e-book prices higher. The question is whether the case and the settlement, which now became officially a settlement, the judge had approved it as of today, the question is whether that's going to change the price of ebooks in the long run. And joining us is Jeff Roberts, legal reporter for GigaOhm's paid content. He previously worked for Reuters and written for the New York Times and The Economist. A former practicing lawyer, Jeff specializes in media-related copyright, patent, and privacy issues. Welcome back to the show, Jeff.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
And Barbara Hernandez is a correspondent for PBS MediaShift covering ebook issues. She has more than a decade of experience as a professional journalist and college writing instructor, and also writes for Press Here, NBC Bay Area's technology blog. Welcome to the show, Barbara.
Thanks. Nice being here.
So we'll start with you, Jeff. You've been covering the settlement that's going on with the big book publishers. What was the kind of reasoning behind this lawsuit? People said that it was Amazon was kind of a driving force behind it, but why did all the states and the Department of Justice, why were they so interested in bringing this case?
Well, it was high profile. Amazon was egging them on. It's also a Democratic administration. And Democrats generally try to appear more pro-consumer. And also, frankly, the appearances of price fixing were pretty dramatic. Meeting together in Manhattan restaurants, changing the pricing system and so on. I mean, I'm not saying they did or didn't, but it was very high profile. And it gets the government a lot of headlines, making it look like they're fighting for consumers. So the government loved it.
Were you surprised to see today that the judge approved the settlement? Because I know previously the thought was the judge was going to wait until the rest of the case played out between Apple and the other two publishers before they actually approved the settlement. But it sounds like the judge just decided to go ahead and approve it.
Yeah, this is a big surprise today. The judge just didn't do just that. She canceled the hearings that were coming up because there's all these public comments posted in which two of the publishers said, wait a minute, and Apple said, wait a minute, and all these authors and bookstores and everyone else said, wait a minute. So generally you give, you know, sort of people their day in the sun or the time in the court, But the judge long ago made up her mind and just sort of said, okay, enough of this. And this means that within 7 days, the price of ebooks could start dropping. It's quite remarkable.
And part of the settlement is that there people who bought ebooks from those publishers will get this kind of, I guess, credit for between 25 cents and $1.32 for each ebook that they bought during a specific time frame. But it'll go into a credit. So, you know, how you use that credit, you're probably going to end up buying more ebooks. So, in a way, this is kind of a settlement that might help the publishers out. I mean, is that how you see it, Barbara?
Well, I don't really think this is going to be helping the consumer out too much. I mean, 25 cents for a book, you know, you bought between 2010 and 2012, April 1st, 2010 to May 21st, 2012, isn't going to be making your bank account bigger. However, I mean, supposedly this is also going to be striking down the whole agency model of pricing on Amazon. So maybe we'll see it going back to something like $9.99 per download or not. I guess we're kind of going to have to watch and wait and see.
At least I'll be able to save hundreds. I might get $100 back.
Because you're a big ebook buyer, right, Rafat?
You're guessing by the amount of books that I've bought and not read, but yes.
I guess if you haven't read it, you still get a rebate, huh?
Yeah, I mean, but it's only $1.32 if you bought one on the New York Times bestseller list. If not, it goes down to 32 cents, and then 25 cents if it's more than a year. So,
$5. Okay.
So, I mean, you know, there's not that huge amount you're going to get back, but hopefully this means it's going to be getting rid of that the agency model pricing and making it more competitive. And I don't know if Amazon's going to be able to go back to selling, you know, below cost, which was kind of the big problem for publishers, but we'll see how it goes.
Jeff, what do you think about this, the new, at least what they're announcing? They've got basically cheaper Kindles. They're announcing serial versions of ebooks that are going to come out. They've done really well with these Kindle singles, these kind of long form, non-book type things. I mean, do you feel like today was kind of a big kind of victory for Amazon in some ways with the settlement and with their new line of gadgets?
It's a good day for Amazon. It's a remarkable company because they do a very good job of sort of staying below the government's radar. Google's always in trouble. Apple's getting in trouble. But Amazon, I think people are underestimating how powerful they've become because it's not the books. It's the marketing data. And that's why the publishers hate them, is because they won't share their marketing data. And all of these new Kindles you see, they're not just reading platforms, of course. They're personal shopping devices with which Amazon probably has richer marketing data on the American consumer than anyone ever has before. And every time you buy a book or you buy, you know, flowers on it or whatever you buy on these things, you're giving them more marketing information. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but I think people have to start realizing just how powerful this company's becoming.
I mean, definitely what they're selling, the Kindles are definitely, they're not making any money on them. This is all to kind of extend their footprint out in the marketplace, which is why Apple, or at least Steve Jobs, was not that happy about the whole situation.
Yeah, and then we've got Apple coming out. You know, they're going to come out with a new iPhone, and then later, you know, we hear rumors about an iPad mini that I guess would be cheaper and would kind of try to take on the Kindle Fire. So it's like the Kindle Fire is getting bigger and the iPad's getting smaller, and it seems like there's just more ways that they're going to be competing now.
Definitely, but I think people who really love the iOS are going to be sticking with it. People who aren't as big of a fan of Apple, or maybe who are looking for something very cheap, may go definitely the Kindle route.
Yeah, I mean, $69 now is their lowest price for the new Kindle. I mean, that's getting to the point where they almost are giving it away. I mean, that's just getting so cheap.
Yeah, well, at least how their model is they're not trying to make money on them. They are simply trying to get them out there so people keep using Amazon to buy everything.
And one of the other questions for the publishers is that, you know, they've always wanted to kind of charge this premium amount. to kind of keep their margins up, because, you know, how much it costs to basically create a book in the past was obviously much higher than it is now when you've got all these kind of automated systems and you've got people who can kind of self-publish everything, and there's so many ways to kind of create a book much cheaper. And I think the publishers, with, you know, with this kind of price fixing idea, whether they did it or not, they really did want to keep the prices up because they want to kind of keep their, you know, profitability and margins up.
Well, yeah, that's the agency model, which they were charging such a high amount for the books, as if you were buying a hardcover edition, even though you were actually buying a digital copy of the book.
Did windowing come into any of the discussions about publishers holding back books in ebooks? And then I know some of the high profile books tried that, but did that trend ever take out or take off, or did that, is that not even part of the discussion these days?
You're seeing less discussion about windowing now than you used to. That's a good question. But I mean, the problem is the publishers are getting knocked around because they used to make their money on hardcovers, but no one's buying those anymore. And so, you know, waiting around to offer the ebook, I think few people are doing that now. I mean, I think, Rafat, you probably have a good long view of the whole thing, but my take on it is the publishers are now finally at where the record companies were 10 years ago. We've seen the other content industries wrestle with digitization. Record companies got hit first, then the movie industry, then newspapers, and now it's finally the writing's on the wall for the publishers. So, you know, I don't think it's at a point where windowing or price fixing or anything can really save them. I think we're just in such a new paradigm that some of these publishers might not even be here in a few years.
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate you joining us for the show.
Thanks a lot. It's always an honor. Thank you, guys.
Great. It was nice being here. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. I want to thank my co-host Rafat Ali, as well as our guests from Charlotte, Adam Sharp, Adam Connor, and Ari Melber, as well as Jeff Roberts and Barbara Hernandez. We want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Be sure to keep up with all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, Idea Lab, at pbs.org/idealab, and our new site, Collaboration Central, at collaborationcentral.org. We'll catch you next week.